was a night. Ooh, what a night it was, really was such a night. The moon was bright. Ooh, how bright it was, really was such a night. The night was alive with stars above. Ooh, when she kissed me.
Good evening, this is Mark Lynch. And this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is journalist and author Steve Bergsman. And we're talking about his book, Have Mercy, Baby, The Life of Clyde McFatter. Steve, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Mark, it's been a while.
It's been a while. But I have to ask you, you've written several books about great artists, vocal artists, or musical groups, but it's not the obvious ones. So how did you start down this road of writing these biographies?
It was by accident. Somebody came to me to do a memoir, write a memoir with Beverly Lee of the Shirelles.
Oh, wow.
So Beverly was a very difficult person, and the first couple of people that it was an agent. He brought a couple of people to her, and she declined to work with them. And then he said to me, would you try it? So I went to New York. I was going to New York anyway. I went to New York, and I took Beverly out to lunch, and we got along fine, and we wrote the book. And then the Shirelles, this was about 10 years ago, and the Shirelles, you know, the peak time for nostalgia is when you're in your 40s. So we were past that peak time.
I was going to say.
Girl group nostalgia. So there wasn't, there were some offers, but they weren't grand. And Beverly thought she should get grand offers.
Oops.
So she took her book off the market, never to be seen again.
Oh, no.
So, the next one to come up, there was a guy who played in the band with Screamin' Jay Hawkins. And he had a band, and there was a guy in his band named Johnny Ace. And I kept thinking he was talking about Johnny Ace, the 1950s teen idol.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. And I didn't know he had been in Screamin' Jay Hawkins' band. But we started conversing, and he said that to me. And he said, you know, you should write a book about Screamin' Jay Hawkins because he was an interesting fellow.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, okay, but, you know, I only know one thing about Screamin' Jay Hawkins. He sang,
Put a Spell on You, yeah.
So that sort of took me down that road of obscure, but what I thought very important people who contributed to the, you know, the early growth of rock and roll, and that sort of became my niche. Those years from the late 40s through the 50s, and I just fell into it. And so those are my most popular books. Though I did do the Dixie Cups,
yeah.
But that's only because they had a compelling story, and I thought I'd write that book. So
how did you choose? How did you choose Clyde McFatter?
He was like, you know, I wrote an early book about Johnny Ace. It was historical fiction. It was a novel, but it was a story of Black teen idol Johnny Ace from 52 to 54. Because I always knew his story, where he played Russian roulette before a concert and lost.
Oops.
And I always wanted to write, and I wrote it in as a novel because I figured, who the heck is going to remember who Johnny Ace was? So I thought it would probably be better off as a novel. And Clyde McFadden, to me, Clyde McFadden was in that obscure area, and I thought he was important for a lot of reasons, even though I knew nobody remembered him. But he, you know, he had been with the Dominoes.
Right.
Then he had been founded the Drifters, and then he had an important solo career. And as you know, he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame twice. So, but I think he could be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame three times if they ever inducted the Dominoes into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So, yeah. So I thought he had a very interesting career, and I don't know. It's just one of those people who I was intrigued about.
You had the foreword written by Ronald Isley of the Isley Brothers. How did you manage that?
How did I manage that? I'm trying to think how I got hooked up with Ronald Isley. I think I had interviewed him for something, and then I just asked him if he wanted to write the foreword, and he was a big Clyde McFadden fan, and he jumped at the opportunity to write the foreword. So I was pretty happy about that.
It's amazing.
Ronald's a pretty nice guy.
As you write about in the book, Clyde McFadden was a huge influence. His voice, this is a quote from your book, would shape future generations of soul singers, people like Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye, Ronnie Isley, Curtis Mayfield, Aaron Neville. All of those people owe their career in part to Clyde McFadden.
Yes. Yeah, he was the voice of the early, he was the most copied voice of the early 1950s in those years of doo-wop. Everybody wanted to sound like Clyde McFadden. That's why you in a lot of doo-wop you have that high tenor. And then he had that great solo career, and you know, all those people you mentioned, they wanted to go that route as well.
Well, as you mentioned before earlier, this was an interesting time period you're focused on. Because if people don't know the history of the music, it was the beginning of doo-wop, but it was a time when R&B artists were gravitating towards rock and roll. And so there's this weird change, sea change happening in popular music.
Yeah, so R&B was going down two routes from the late 1940s. So they were going down the group route, which became doo-wop, and there was also all these precedents like the Orioles and before them the Mills Brothers.
Yep.
So that all worked its way into doo-wop, which really hit pretty hard around 1950, 1951, and lasted for a decade. It evolved from the black sound to the Italian-American sound, you might say, into the 60s. So that doo-wop was important, but at the same time, mainstream R&B going back to the late 40s was beginning to produce a sound that was pretty close to the basic beat of rock and roll. So there was two things going on at the same time. You had the group sound and you had the sort of pre-rock and roll sound, like Good Rockin' Tonight from 48 and things like that. And if you look at the career of Clyde McFadden, so Dominoes were a doo-wop group, but the song Have Mercy Baby was a rocking song. That was really pre-rock and roll. So, you know, they were doing both sides of R&B, the Dominoes. They were doing sort of the doo-wop. They were doing sort of traditional blues with 60 Minute Man, and then they were doing pre-rock and roll at the same time. So that's why I always thought they were pretty important. And that's by the 1950s, you know, early 1950s, 53, 54, 52, you know, this pre-rock and roll sound was evolving, just as the group sound was evolving in doo-wop. I think Shake, Rattle, and Roll probably 53 or 54. That was the ultimate pre-rock and roll song.
Clyde McFadder, who was the lead singer of the Dominoes, he would replace Sonny Till as the foremost teen idol. And it's amazing how few people remember him today.
Yeah, it's a strange world because I read a lot of rock and roll, you might say histories, how rock and roll started. And, well, I have to for all these books. And you always hear about the teens, the Bobby Soxers of Frank Sinatra.
Or
about 1950, the next big star with a teen fan following, Johnny Ray. And then you skip to Elvis Presley. But on the African-American side of America, you might say, they had their own teen idols as well. So Sonny Till and the Orioles, you know, when they showed up for a concert, then you had all the black teens, you know, screaming and wailing and hollering. But you never read about that. So people don't understand. Okay, they were really, even in pop music, there were really two sides. There were, you know, the white crooners of the late 40s into the early 50s. And then there was the whole black scene that it was never covered by the mainstream publications, so you never heard about it.
It's amazing. Have Mercy Baby was the third most popular R&B song of 1952. And the Dominoes opened up for Dinah Washington in 1951, and she was furious. Why was she furious?
Well, Dinah Washington... I'll probably have to do a Dinah Washington book because she was so great.
Oh, yeah.
She was the most consistent and ultimate female R&B singer in the 1950s. But she had her start in the 40s, and she was known as the queen of the jukeboxes. So she was thought of herself. She had a very high self-esteem. And she didn't want to appear after the Dominoes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, she didn't want to appear after the Dominoes because, the Dominoes put on an exciting show, and B, they really rocked the crowd. Once, you know, they did have Mercy Baby, they really rocked the crowd and got the crowd all worked up, where Dinah Washington, she was a great singer, but she was a solo, and she sang a lot of sort of slow ballads. That was her forte. So,
So who wouldn't want to follow the Dominoes? I wouldn't want to follow the Dominoes. No.
No. So even as important, and she had a great following, but You don't want to follow the Beatles, right? If you were on that lineup.
That's like on the Ed Sullivan Show, the poor people that had to follow the Beatles when they appeared.
Yeah, who even remembers who they were?
Right. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is journalist and author Steve Bergsman. And we're talking about his book, Have Mercy, Baby: The Life of Clyde McFadder. There's so many people in the book, and let's just talk about a few of them. And these people are crucial to the whole history of rock, but few people remember who they are or know of them. Ahmet Erdogan. Who was he? And how did he play a role in Clyde's career?
So Ahmet Erdogan founded Atlantic Records, and through the 1950s, Atlantic Records was the greatest purveyor of R&B records. So they had Big Joe Turner, for example, yeah, that was Shake, Rattle, and Roll. And
I still love that song, by the way.
Yeah, that's the Joe Turner version, not the Bill Haley and the
Comets. No, 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 no. It's got to be the Joe Turner version.
Yeah, because Bill Haley, you know, cleaned it up.
Yeah, yeah. No, I like the other version.
Yeah, so the Atlantic Records story, I mean, they were just the best. They had a full lineup of R&B. Ruth Brown.
Wow.
Probably the best R&B singer of the 1950s. She came out of Atlantic. And there were a few more. I'm not getting them all. But they were important. Anyway, so Clyde sang with the Dominoes. And the way it worked, if you think of a group and you think, well, it's a band, like a band, like we think of today, a band, and you know, four or five guys, they get together in a garage and they and somehow they bang out a hit record, and they're all, each one of the four or five guys are principals in that band. Back then, somebody had the concept of a group. They formed it, they owned the group, and they found the people to sing. So you, when you were in that group, like the Dominoes, you were more or less a hired hand.
Got it.
You didn't. All the money flowed into the guy who owned the copyright of the Dominoes name. Hmm. So that's the way it worked for a lot of the groups back in the 50s, especially in the black groups. It wasn't five guys getting together, because on a street corner, it was one guy said, I have an idea for a group. I'm going to give it a name, and I'm going to hire four guys to sing it. And they were basically on salary.
Now, so, within the Dominoes, Billy yeah. Ward was really jealous of Clyde McFadder.
Yeah, so Billy Ward wanted the best singer for his new group, the Dominoes, and he wanted Clyde McFadder, and Clyde McFadder was still a teenager. But Billy Ward was an autocrat, and he was very, very difficult person, and he had his rules. And if you were in the Dominoes, you had to follow Billy Ward rules.
Huh.
So going back to Ahmet Erdogan, there was finally, after a couple of years, Clyde McFadder, he was getting older, he was getting tired of the rules. Billy Ward weren't getting along, and either he quit or Billy said, I fired him. But in either case, he was gone from the Dominoes. And Ahmet Erdogan, when he heard that, he basically ran out that night to find Clyde McFadder anywhere in Harlem. He knew he was around somewhere, and he wasn't with the Dominoes anymore. So he wanted to find him because he was the voice. Erdogan knew Clyde was the voice, not only of the Dominoes, but of that generation of singers. And he found him, hired him, and he said to Clyde, go form your own group. And that group was the original Drifters. And the first song they had is a classic, Money Honey.
Yeah.
Number one R&B song, copied by just about everybody, but the best is still the original Money Honey by the Drifters.
With, obviously, Clyde McFadder, lead singer.
With Clyde McFadder, the lead singer. So what happened, so the Drifters got off to a roaring start, and then what happened to a lot of black singers, they were young, and this was the Korean War and post-Korean War days, and they all got drafted, and Clyde McFadder got drafted. So he had to lead the Drifters, more or less. you know, he wasn't posted overseas. He was posted near New York City. He could come in and on his leave and still record with the Drifters. But by the time he got out of the service, the Drifters kind of moved on, and so did he. And then that started his solo career.
He had an incredible solo career, too. He really did. And then, unfortunately, he just drank a lot and became unreliable. And the end of his story in your book is just tragic.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues that Clyde had. These were personal issues that he had. And I tried to get to the bottom of this, but it was very difficult. Going back to Ruth Brown, she had an affair with Clyde McFadder. And when she wrote her biography, she said she knew he was bisexual. And because he had that very high voice, a lot of people assumed that he was gay. And there is a lot of evidence that he was gay, or as Ruth said, bisexual. But there are people close to him who said he wasn't gay. And I couldn't come to find enough evidence either way to declare one way or another. But I did raise the whole question of gay singers at that period of time in the right. 1950s. But anyway, if he was gay, and that's possible, or probable, you might say, he never let on. He always lived the life of a straight man.
Well, he had a reputation as a womanizer.
He had a great reputation as a womanizer, and he married three times. But neither of those marriages were very important to him. Mm-hmm. And once he got married, he spent very little time with those women. So,
but the story of his becoming unreliable as a performer is just like this classic story of an amazing and important performer immolating his career, as you write in the book. I mean, it really was just self-destructive to the nth degree.
Yeah, so so he may have had these very deep personal interest, personal issues that he tried to hide, and maybe that was a reason why he turned to the bottle. But over time, he turned to the bottle more and more. He became very thin-skinned. In some regards, he became difficult to work with. And he started out, if you knew Clyde McFadder in the early 1950s, he was the sweetest guy. People
yeah,
tell
yeah.
you the sweetest guy in the world. But over time, the personal issues and then the descent into alcoholism really sort of destroyed his career and then it was all self-destruction.
He passed away June 13th, 1972 in New York. He went overseas to perform in Britain, but that didn't really work out. It's really tragic because everybody who has heard him, who knew him, say he could really sell a song. His voice was like nobody else's. And he had the matinee idol looks. He had sort of the perfect everything going for him, but then just sort of immolated his career. Now, we're almost out of time, which is too bad. There's an awful lot in your book. But at the end of the book, there's a picture of you with Clyde McFadder's daughter, Deborah. Talk to me about that.
Oh, Deborah was really a great help to me in this book. When I decided to write about Clyde, I connected with Deborah through the internet. And I asked her, you know, if she would help me, and she did. She was a great help and filled in a lot of missing pieces. She had a lot of material for me, personal letters, although she said a lot of the letters that were sent to her by her father, she destroyed. So, but she still had a lot of stuff that I could use for this book. And Deborah was a real sweetheart about it. And she and I actually are going to do a book signing at the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame in June.
That's amazing. That's very cool. So wait a minute. Why did she destroy all his letters? Was she not happy with them?
Well, she never really got to know him later in life.
Yep.
Of course, she. So in the book, it explains that there was only one woman he really loved, and it was he loved her because she was unattainable because she married somebody else. So he had these other marriages, but they really weren't very important to him, and he kept up a friendship relationship with Deborah McBatter's mother through his whole life, and it was only later on in life that Deborah got to know him. And unfortunately, these were the unpredictable years of Clyde McFadder.
That's too bad.
So there were good moments with her father, and there were stressful moments with her father.
Oh, wow.
So I think she destroyed some of those letters because he was a prolific letter writer, and I don't know what was in those letters.
We're out of time. My returning guest tonight is journalist and author Steve Bergsman, and we've been talking about his book, Have Mercy, Baby, The Life of Clyde McFadder. Steve, it's always a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, Mark, thank you very much for having me on your show.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.
It was a night, ooh, what a night it was, really was such a night. The moon was